Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Funding for On Point provided by Liberty Mutual Insurance for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The state of Colorado has been a high-altitude stage for an unbelievable number of the country's hot issues lately, playing out against the Rockies in a kind of national theater in the round. We're all watching as Colorado pushes boundaries and buttons on fracking, pot, guns, even secession threats, plus epic fire and flood. We are going there today, this hour on Point, the riveting state of Colorado. We have three interesting Coloradans with us today, different faces of that state from different locales, different perspectives. From conservative Colorado Springs, Laura DiSilverio joins us, an Air Force intelligence officer for 20 years. Today she's a novelist, author of the Swift Investigations and Mall Cop mystery series and the Ballroom Dance series under the pen name Ella Barrick. Laura DiSilverio in Colorado Springs, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
From Fort Collins, Colorado, a little crunchier maybe, John Long joins us. He's founder and director of Biodiesel for Bands, a nonprofit that offers touring artists, musicians, deep discounts on biodiesel fuel and touring vehicles. He's got four startups under his belt, all of them in environmental sustainability. John Long in Fort Collins, Colorado. Welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. And last but not least, Patty Limerick joins us, professor of history at the University of Colorado, chair of the board there of the Center of the American West, MacArthur Fellow, author of Desert Passages, The Legacy of Conquest, and A Ditch in Time. She's in Washington today, one of the nation's most respected historians of the West. Patty Limerick of Colorado, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Good to be here.
It's great to have all of you with us. Patty, I'm going to come first to you. What's going on in this great state? You are just grabbing headline after headline for the past year and more now. We know it's gone from kind of Republican red to purple or even blue, but it's got red streaked all through it. What is going on with the social, political, moving profile of Colorado, Patty?
Well, let's start with the fact that Colorado has been incredibly interesting for 140 or 50 or 60 years.
Okay.
And it's nice that the rest of you are on board with me now.
Yes.
It's really,
we're right here.
But it is a place. It is a central place. It's been in the center of the country. It's in the center of between Canada and Mexico. It's really a place to keep your eye on. It has such a combination of economies. It has extractive industries. It has recreational and amenity settlement and high tech. And so it's just, if there's something that interests you about the United States, we're going to be particularly interesting because we have so much there, such a diversity of ethnic populations, such a diversity of landscapes, such a set of questions about how is our past connecting us to a future. So I'm so happy that we're all on board with this now because really I've been saying, as a Western American historian, I have seen this as a place of extreme interest for a really long time. The transformation of Colorado Springs, the way in which Fort Collins is kind of like Boulder, Colorado, as a liberal college town, but kind of tied to those plains and to the agricultural world as well. So it's heaven. It's case study heaven.
Case study heaven. Heaven, I don't know, maybe so. John Long, here we are. I mean, this week you've got your governor there rolling out or unveiling what he hopes will eventually be the toughest regulations in the country on pollution coming out of fracking wells. I mean, a year ago, you had the green light for pot in Colorado. We had the terrible shooting in Aurora, then some gun reform, then the recalls that got everybody's attention, where a couple of politicians were gone after by the NRA and more and taken right out of their seats for supporting gun reform. How do you understand what's going on in your state now, John? Is it plunging into the future? Is it edging sideways? Are you the national laboratory for this country?
Yeah, very much so. You know, it's ground zero here in Colorado for a lot of these new fields that are emerging, and it's a real opportunity for Colorado to become a leader and set the stage for the nation.
Is it is this the face of the new United States? Is this a permanent change that Colorado's pushing forward? Is it just, you know, a moment and you've got conservatives ready to take it back in another direction, John?
Yeah, the future is a little unknown still, but, you know, this the good thing is that the discussion is taking place. A lot of these issues have been skirted around for so long, and now they're front and center, national scale, and I think it deserves that attention.
Here's Governor Hickenlooper. This was on Monday. The Colorado's Democratic governor unveiled the state's, the nation's first toughest air quality regulations addressing the release of the greenhouse gas methane and carcinogenic volatile organic compounds from fracking wells. Hickenlooper.
These are going to amount to the very best air quality rules in the country. I think they represent the most protective state regulations in existence to make sure that we're protecting the air that our children and our families breathe.
But you've got pushback as well that goes so far as saying we want out of Colorado. A secession movement called the 51st State Amendment they're looking for that would create a new state in conservative portions of Colorado. Here's Wayne County Commissioner Sean Conway. He's on that beam.
Urban legislators imposed one standard on rural Colorado and exempted themselves out of that same standard for their urban constituents. One might call that tyranny. I get phone calls on a regular basis, at least once a week, from citizens in other states that saying, hey, what are you guys doing out there? How are you doing this?
Laura DeSilverio, you're up in more conservative Colorado Springs. Where do you see this state going?
Well, I think on that last issue with the secession, I think that what the gentleman was referring to was that the rural cooperative electric associations are now mandated to get 20% of their energy from renewable sources by 2020, and the urban areas were exempted from that requirement. So I think the secession issues, the secession movement, is more about constituents feeling that they are not being heard by their elected representatives than it is about any real desire to form a 51st state.
Though they've got that out there, I guess it's not going anywhere, but they're raising that flag and waving that flag. Patty Limerick, remind us of when Colorado began its most recent turn from solid red Republican into the pretty blue state that it is now, with still strong red stripes or polka dots, as you will, through it.
Well, if you go back 30 or 40 years, there's a pattern of interior western states having considerably more mixed election patterns, of having, for instance, Democratic governor much more often than you would expect for a Western American state. My feeling as a historian is that around the 1970s, mid and late 1970s, the recognition of how dramatic an effect the environmental laws passed in the 1960s and 1970s, what an effect that was having on locales, how much more federal authority there was in decisions about what kind of economic development would occur. I think that's when you see more and more and more election of Republicans from not just Colorado, but from the interior west in general, to the Senate and to the House. But sometimes even that pattern is a little bit muddled. But still, I think you can see that reaction to the environmental laws. And that stuck for a while. And then what we've asked ourselves 1,000 times and not come up with a great answer, what happens to a state when so many of the people moving into the state are coming over the last 30 or 40 years because it's beautiful, because it has outdoor recreation opportunities beyond belief, so that people moving to Denver may be living in a city, but so much of their, many of the people who moved there are coming because of the extraordinary opportunities to be out in nature. So what happens to a state when so many people are coming in, when there's such a high growth rate? Some of the Colorado counties had the highest growth rate of any place in the nation. What happens? How will those people sort themselves out? Will they see gun issues from a middle-class urbanite's perspective, or will they have been drawn to Colorado because it's about independence and about freedom, and will they react against gun regulations because that's conflicting with the ideal that drew them? So in the last, I would say, probably 5 or 6 years, that question, how does that changing demographic, political, cultural character of the residents of Colorado, how is that working out? To some degree, the rural counties with the secession thing are reacting against just that demographic change of who are these strangers and where have they come from and why are they voting citizens in Colorado, and what about those of us who've been in these rural areas for families for decades and decades. So it's that big question. What happens when you change a state's population as dramatically as Colorado's has been changing over the last 30 or 40 years? But now it's really coming to bear on just about every issue of civic life.
John Long, 10 years ago, you had Republican governor, Republican legislature, two Republican U.S. senators, and now all that reversed, Democratic, Democratic, Democratic. How do you explain it? Is it demographic at its heart?
I think I agree. You know, a lot of people have been moving here from around the country with more liberal stances, and the native population of Colorado is still very conservative, but it's, you know, creating an interesting environment politically. But at the same time, it's where the trend is going in the nation. So it's again, ground zero for a lot of these issues starting out here in Colorado.
Does it feel like you're working toward a balance that works with Coloradans understanding one another, or you've just got this big dividing line down through the population?
It is very divisive. I mean, there's no denying that. People have extreme views on several of these issues, and it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out in the next decade.
John Long, please stand by there in Fort Collins, Colorado. Patty Limerick from the University of Colorado. Laura DiSilverio in Colorado Springs. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the state of Colorado pushing lots of boundaries and buttons lately on fracking, gun law, marijuana, more. Looking at what's going on up there. A year ago, it was Colorado giving the green light to marijuana use. Here was the top story on Fox 31 Denver's Good Day Colorado, November 7th, a year ago, the morning after Coloradans voted to legalize the recreational use of marijuana.
Well, there was the reaction, hugs and cheering as Colorado becomes one of the first states to legalize the recreational use of marijuana. Amendment 64 faced a tough battle, but voters pushed it through. This was a wide margin, too, 55% to 45%.
We had the Aurora shootings, then Colorado gun reform law. In the wake of that, a move to recall some of the politicians who were involved with that, two of them taken right out in those votes. Here, Colorado then Senate President John Morse and another Democratic colleague who lost their seats in that recall election on September 10th were pushed out by those who did not want gun law reform. Here's Morse, the then Senate president, after his loss, saying it was all worth it.
We had to do gun safety. And I said months ago, if passing gun safety bills cost me my political career, that's an amazingly small price to pay. The families of these victims have to pay a huge price every single day for the rest of their lives.
And then the weather running through it all. We've seen fire and flood back in September, heavy rain causing catastrophic flooding along Colorado's Front Range from Colorado Springs north to Fort Collins. Here was part of ABC News meteorologist Ginger Z's report on September 14th.
Within 1 hour, it completely surrounded the entire house and we had current.
In Weld County, farms isolated on islands.
Never ever has this water been this high. I've got three horses. I hope they're alive. We had to get out so quick.
And it was tough reality there in fire over the summer and flood just a couple of months ago. Laura DiSilverio is with us today from Colorado Springs, novelist, author there, watching what's going on from a kind of conservative part of Colorado. John Long is with us from Fort Collins, a little more earthy, crunchy. Colorado's got plenty of that. He runs Biodiesel for Bands, been involved with a lot of environmental sustainability startups. Patty Limerick is with us, one of the nation's most respected historians of the West. She's at the University of Colorado in the center of the American West, their chair there. You can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'd like to just walk through these issues because there's so many of them. Can we start with pot? I mean, Patty, how do you explain how Colorado, along with Washington State, became first in the nation to give the full green light for recreational use of marijuana?
Well, I have my own thought here, which is that we just came down with fatigue. We had so much coverage and so much discussion about medical marijuana and the licensing of medical marijuana and doctors who are overprescribing it. So I think this is just probably my own personal angle, but that had become the world's most boring story. It was so endless and so overcovered. And the joy of just saying, okay, let's not fight this battle anymore, that I think must have been some factor for some people. But it's also that it's that strange demographic movement that you have so many interesting people who are, we have a lot of young people who are out of a college environment fairly recently who may wonder why these, I mean, really, you do have to say, why prohibition for alcohol? And why not do that if you're going to prohibit marijuana? Which is the more dangerous of those? There are many good reasons to ask about it, but then when you put in there as well, the freedom, the independence and the freedom. This is a state where we don't let government get in our way until we need government's help for floods and dealing with floods, for kind of an ambivalent attitude towards government, but one that you can count on a good percentage of people saying, let's have government not be meddling in our private choices. So there we have fatigue, sense of independence, big presence of young people, recent college graduates, and so on, and I guess it comes together.
Laura, what kind of reception have you seen for that law in Colorado Springs, for the liberalization on marijuana laws in Colorado?
Well, I think Patty's hit it right in terms of why we ended up with the marijuana law passing as it did, the issue of fatigue and the demographics primarily. What is interesting about that law is that it was left up to the individual cities and municipalities to decide whether or not to allow sales of recreational marijuana in their towns and the areas they're responsible for. Colorado Springs, as you probably know, the city council voted against having those sales at this time. I think an interesting and probably the smart way to go initially, I mean, obviously the people have spoken, the marijuana sales are legalized, but I think it's smart to watch and look at some of the other communities who are going ahead with those sales in their areas to see what that impact is. You know, does it attract an out-of-state brand of tourist focused only on obtaining marijuana that might or might not be good for the community as a whole? I think the opportunity for the city to instate sales if they want to at a later date, if they see that it's not having negative impacts, is still there. They'll still be able to reap the tax benefits as some of the other communities already are at a later time.
John Long in Fort Collins, do you see the new recreational use law settling comfortably into Colorado culture now, or is it going to be a checkerboard, embraced here, opposed there, even as it's legal statewide?
It sure has started out that way, but I think, you know, this is a real opportunity to show other counties, other cities, and other states that this is a real economic generator for our schools. School funding is record low in Colorado, and this is going to help that tremendously. While, you know, I think I mimic a lot of the thoughts that the others said, that, you know, it's not a very dangerous drug. It's not very different than alcohol. It should be treated the same as alcohol. And, you know, some towns will want it out. In fact, Fort Collins even voted to keep dispensaries out of city limits, but that doesn't mean that they can't be right outside the city. So it's really not much of an issue. They're just losing out on a tax base right now, which eventually I think they're going to want to capture. So I see a lot of cities and counties maybe turning around on that stance.
Patty, it's so interesting to see how this is playing out. Denver Post this morning, front page, is all about whether or not it will be legal in Denver to smoke pot in your front yard, or you've got to keep it a little bit under the covers, even as it's legal. The issue of tax revenues, a giant one, and such an interesting pair of votes, Patty, recently in Colorado, where big support voting for significant taxes on and revenue from the newly legalized marijuana, but big opposition to, and a lot of those revenues going to education in Colorado, but huge opposition, Patty, to a proposed new tax hike on incomes that would have brought nearly $1 billion to education. What do you make of that vote, Patty?
Well, I'm in education, so yeah. We've got me representing a special interest group here, I guess. I'm not entirely getting why it would seem like a good calculation. Well, let me change my mind here. At first, it seems to me the education of young people is such a crucial element of citizen well-being. So you could be quite anti-tax for other reasons, but you would think, this is our future. It does us no good to have children who are ill-equipped for the world. However, as I initially said, I don't understand it, but in fact, how could I not understand it? Because there is a real question about efficiency in education spending. There's considerable disagreement in that world of education, actually kind of vast disagreement,
mm-hmm.
disagreement about what are workable techniques, how do the teaching to the standards and the tests fit with the actual education of a thinking good citizen. So there's some significant level of confusion and disorder in the project of education. So I guess when I think more about it, I can see why a person could say, if I could believe that government will take this added money and put it to effective use to create thinking good citizens, I would support that. But I can also see why citizens would think, oh yeah, more money for a bureaucratic structure that does not seem to fully have charted its course in the world. I guess I can see both of those things.
Laura, what do you make of this pair of votes? On the one hand, 62 counties turned down a small increase in income tax that would have raised $1 billion for education. Only Denver and Boulder counties voting for it. 65 to 35% defeat for that. On the other hand, big support in the state for tax revenues from new marijuana sales going to education. What do you make of those, Laura?
Well, let me start by saying that I have two children in the public schools of Colorado Springs. So education for me, as with Patty, is very much of great interest. I agree with what I think Patty was saying, that voters are very skeptical of promises that spending more in education is going to lead to better outcomes for the kids. I don't think that this was in any way a vote against education or a vote to say that education in Colorado is not important. I think it was a vote against handing over more power and more money without any sort of guarantee or promise that there was going to be an increase in the scores of third grade reading levels or higher graduation rates or anything of that sort. Contrasting with that with the marijuana thing, I think mm-hmm. it will be up to the communities involved to say where that money goes. If it goes to education, hallelujah, I would sure like to see somebody trying to track from the dollars put into the system to outcomes. And I think that an Amendment 66 type proposition would have better luck in the future, more support from a broader base if there were more outcomes to be seen.
Of course, that marijuana tax being widely sold as a way of getting some cash in behind education in Colorado at the same time as a direct income tax that would go there. Big no from Colorado. We're looking at the state of Colorado today. You can join us at 800-423-8255. A lot going on there. The whole country watching. Mark in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I'm a guy in Nashville, Tennessee, who has grown for about 15 years clandestinely, mostly just for my own enjoyment.
You're talking about growing pot. Okay, yeah.
And I'm I've been a user for over 30 years, and I'm moving back to Colorado. I'm a native of Denver, and I'm moving back to grow and take part in the green rush, and I'm switching careers, and really look forward to living out my dream of growing pot without the government, being able to hold me up by my thumbs if I happen to get caught.
The green rush and moving back to Colorado to be part of it. What do you expect when you get there? You're a Colorado native. What do you see in this state? Is this the future of this country? Is this a test case, a petri dish? What do you see, Mark?
I think it is a test case. I think with this long prohibition that's been in place, now we have 58% in polls that are saying that they favor legalizing marijuana. They see the incredible amount of resources that are, I think completely wasted on a drug that is not dangerous at all. And not to mention, the 750,000 annual arrests for marijuana. I'd love to see the cottage industry of the courts end as it pertains to marijuana. A person gets caught here for just any small amount over an ounce. And, you're peeing for the judge and you're fined and, $15,000, $20,000 later, you've got your little life back, but then you have a smudge on your record. What's it all about,
So there you are, Mark, headed back to Colorado For the green rush, it is so interesting how this country is a checkerboard these days, and Colorado really pushing boundaries within that. Let me get one more right here. Ray in Essex, Connecticut. Ray, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Tom. My wife and I followed our dream in 1999 and moved to a ranch on the western slope near Rifle, Colorado.
Beautiful.
We were eventually driven out by the gas drilling that we knew was going on a distance, but eventually sort of crept all around us and turned the ranch into an industrial zone. But the point I wanted to make was an observation in a wonderful book I read, and of course I can't remember the author. It was 10 or 12 years ago, written by, I believe, a Los Angeles Times correspondent, and to describe the sociology of the country within 50 miles of the Continental Divide, going from New Mexico up to up to Canada, and in one sentence, he described this area has people that are nowhere in the country are they as angry and upset about intrusions by the federal government, and yet nowhere in the country are they more dependent upon the federal government's largesse for their own well-being in terms of mining, drilling, putting their cattle on the national forest, just all the observations about here they are, angry about the hand that feeds them.
So gas drilling drove you out of your dream ranch in Colorado, but here we are this week with new steps being proposed to clean that up. John Long, do you have the sense of Coloradans saying, all right, here we go, we're going to be fracking, but it's not going to be dirty in Colorado? Is that the idea?
Well, fracking is a really controversial issue. There's really no way to guarantee its safety of our groundwater and the residents that live near those wells. You know, there's just news coverage every week, every month that has people like the caller, you know, where their groundwater, drinking water has been contaminated, and they can put a lighter under their faucet and get a flame. And there's just really no way to guarantee it. So having cleaner laws is one thing, but Fort Collins just passed a moratorium on fracking within city limits. And there wasn't much here to begin with, but that was a hot topic here in the last election.
This is big move this week, Laura, to say we don't want this exhaust from fracking. We don't want this pollution that comes with it. And interestingly, they had the energy companies standing alongside the governor, at least three of the biggest ones in Colorado, as he announced this. Does that mean there's unanimity about trying to clean it up, Laura?
I think it does. Despite the fact that we have a Democratic governor, he is in favor of fracking. He is on record as saying that he has drunk the fracking fluid, and he's still here to talk about it. I think that having the energy companies on board is encouraging in many ways, that they are willing to work with the state and work with the people and come up with ways of trying to make this safer, specifically, you know, at the moment with reducing the release of methane during the production and transport of natural gas. One of the issues I find more interesting or perhaps more disturbing was brought up by the caller from Rifle, in that there's a property rights issue at work here too, and a lot of people are more disturbed by having the fracking operation essentially set up in their backyard next to the playground equipment than they are with the danger of the fracking process itself.
Of course, I guess what's ultimately disturbing is the danger, right, or the noise or whatever you don't like from it. It drove our caller right off the ranch. Coloradans grappling with that this weekend with a whole lot more in recent months and years. Pot, fracking, guns, we'll look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the state of Colorado, pushing lots of boundaries and buttons lately on fracking, gun law, marijuana. What's going on up there? Fire and flood as well. We go to Marcia in Derby Line, Vermont. Marcia, you're watching all this with us. What do you think?
Well, hi, Tom. I wanted to say to Patty, from the historical context, I'm fascinated by the similarity between the growing pains that seem to be going on in Colorado, comparing them to what happened in Vermont back in the 70s, when there was the large influx of college-educated, politically active, really gung-ho, you know, we love this place, young people who moved in to a conservative Republican farm, you know, agricultural-based state. And in the span of 30 years, we've gone from that conservative Republican lifestyle to one that is quite known for being very liberal and democratic. We are the ones who produced Bernie Sanders, who was also part of our influx there in the
Socialist senator, yeah.
Yeah, I just am thinking, again, of that long-term historical context of, on a much larger scale, of course, is this, you know, what's happening right now in Colorado. I'm fascinated.
Marcia, I appreciate your call. Patty, you suggested that that is no small part of what's going on. How does that work out over time? Do you see it just polka dot, you know, sort of separate bodies within the boundaries of the state, or some kind of new synthesis emerging?
I have, as an historian, an excellent perspective, which is that populations that are in conflict with each other are not always successful in communicating those conflicts to the next generation. And so whites and Indians married each other and had children of mixed ancestry.
Yeah.
So that happens throughout. Well, it happens everywhere, but it certainly has happened in the American West. So I think it's going to get more muddled and just shaken up from the clear categories as we go. I think a really big question is, how are we doing on intermediaries, shuttle diplomats, messengers working between and among the groups? I think our governor is trying really hard to be that kind of shuttle diplomat. And for several years in his term of office, he was really performing at that rate. Then some, I think his concern about the Aurora Theater killing really mobilized him on gun control. That made some of the rural people very upset. But I think the governor is really trying that. Where he is particularly trying to be the shuttle diplomat is on the fracking issue. I'm a member of a National Science Foundation-funded grant on fracking, and we are trying our hardest to be people waiting for evidence before we make assertions. So, for instance, the business about people lighting their faucets on fire,
yeah,
that's often biogenic, which is to say that's methane that is naturally produced and is not necessarily connected to any kind of oil and gas development. That can come into a water well when there's gas development or when there isn't. So a lot of the folklore around fracking is very alarmist. There are genuine, undeniable concerns about the disruption of suburban neighborhoods. But there's also the fact that suburban neighborhoods depend on fossil fuel for their well-being. So really complicated, really hard to get out into the world and to say we are trying to get evidence on the subject of hydraulic fracturing and its impact on human health. Very difficult to do. A lot of people on both sides, pro-industry or anti-industry, are quite certain that they know everything they need to know. But it's really a much more changeable body of evidence, which I know because I'm the humanities person working with a bunch of scientists and engineers on that. But to try to communicate that diplomatically, which I may be failing at even as I speak right now, that's a hard thing. That's a really hard thing. But I think more and more and more people are, and universities can be an important part of this, but people are trying to find ways in which we can translate messages, turn down the noise.
Between right and left, between environmentalist and energy producer, let's say, and politically too.
Well, the Environmental Defense Fund is an environmental group that the state director in Colorado, Dan Grossman, has been heroic in trying to conduct exactly that conversation, trying to get the best behavior from those three companies you mentioned, Noble and Anadarko and Encana, that supported the governor's stronger regulations. Dan has worked very carefully to get those kinds of conversations going, and he's a very credentialed environmentalist, and Dan Grossman is one of those shuttle diplomats. So can our population of shuttle diplomats in Colorado increase in proportion to the conflicts? They might.
Laura, what do you think about that? Do you see new areas of consensus emerging as Colorado pushes forward on these fronts? I mean, here's your governor, Hickenlooper, Democratic governor, who's tried to work, Patty says, as a shuttle diplomat between right and left. Some of the latest numbers show, some polling numbers show some disgruntlement growing with him there. Maybe that's inevitable over time. Do you see shuttle diplomacy or a new conversation opening up between Coloradans of different politics, Laura.
I do. I appreciate the efforts that Governor Hickenlooper is making. I appreciate some of the things that make it onto ballots and that give the general population, the voting eligible population, a voice in the conversation. You know, and you listed off earlier, you know, Senate Democratic, Governor Democratic, House of Representatives Democratic.
The flip from 10 years ago, yeah.
Right. But, you know, when you look at that a little closer, I mean, the Senate is Democratic by one vote.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really much closer than perhaps just the straight statement that, oh, yes, it's all gone Democratic would indicate. And I think there are more conversations. And I think that's very helpful to the state as a whole and maybe even hopefully to the nation.
That kind of brings us to the gun issue. Of course, the big recall push against two of your state politicians there, and both of them pushed out. Big battle there. Michael Bloomberg pouring money in, trying to save them after they supported gun reform. The NRA and others looking to have them out. And now they're looking to what Mount Moore recall could even change that balance in the state legislature. John Lang, what do you make of what happened in Colorado on gun law reform? You had the Aurora shootings and then the reforms, background checks and limits on gun magazines to 15 rounds. Colorado put that through. And then the recalls that pushed these two at least right out. What do you make of that saga, John?
Oh, man, it's a tough one. You know, it's we're not trying to take guns away from citizens. We're trying to make the world safer for people and keeping guns out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them and are committing these crimes. So I'm at a loss to what the controversy is about. Why wouldn't we want background checks? Why wouldn't we want to make it more difficult for these guns to be sold openly to anyone that walks into a gun show? It just seems like it's a no-brainer to me, but I know that there's a whole nother faction, and right here in Colorado, it's very strong.
Patty Limerick, how did you, in the end, see what happened on gun reform and the recalls of those two? I mean, you've got the reforms, but some of those who are at the forefront now gone. Did that seem Colorado homegrown? Did you feel manipulated by national interest there? Bloomberg on the one side, NRA and others on the other? How about it, Patty?
It's such a counter-suggestible group. So, I mean, I personally was not welcoming. I don't welcome the Koch brothers. I don't welcome the Bloomberg funds. I mean, it just seems like, could you, if you want to come chat with us, that would be nice. But to try to spend your way to a outcome, I think if Bloomberg had had any sense, he would have opposed gun control and put millions into that, and that might have rallied people to his cause. It's just, it's not a good strategy.
You mean that people might then have been for it if Bloomberg was against it in Colorado?
That probably mm-hmm. would have turned the election, frankly, because it's just a sense of who is he and why is he intruding here, and the feelings of the interior west towards their northeast and the Atlantic coast. I mean, that's not a good situation to deal with there. I don't know. I mean, I have a very good friend who is I'm not even sure I would try to categorize him politically, but he has always enjoyed the sport of shooting. He's always enjoyed going to target shootings, and he found this intrusive and troubling, and I had the good fortune to have him as a friend. He'll be with us on Thanksgiving dinner, so I can get back to John and to you about what's going on, because he is not a person who has any malevolent desire to see more violence, but he did feel that there were aspects of this that were really intrusions on a legitimate right, and I will take advantage as soon as we get that turkey on the table. But see, but that's Colorado. That's a little bit there. I'm glad I brought up Thanksgiving.
Because yes.
He'll be there.
At the same table in Colorado for Thanksgiving.
Right.
Jeff is calling from Fort Stockton, Texas. Jeff, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know of Colorado, Jeff?
I know I'm not there right now. When I'm going to talk about the tax increase, the income tax increase they were talking about. In my school district, we had approved like five or six different mill levies.
Are you from Colorado, Jeff, and where?
Born and raised, Colorado Springs area.
Got it. Okay.
And we've done like five or six different mill levy increases, which increase our property taxes.
Yeah.
And over the course of those mill levy increases, we haven't seen much improvement. So a lot of the people are going, why do we want an income tax increase when nothing has really been happening? But yet they're going to do like a, they're talking a 15% tax on marijuana to take care of the schools. And a lot of people are saying, why double up?
So what, there's pretty strong vote for that revenue from marijuana. Were you for or against that, Jeff?
I was really for that because of the 15% tax increase, or the 50 cents, 15% tax on the marijuana.
As long as you're going to have it out there recreationally, you might as well get some revenue from it, I guess. What about gun reform, Jeff? Are you for that in Colorado or against it, and why?
Say again, please.
Gun reform. Are you for the reforms there in gun law or against them, and why?
I am not a gun owner myself, and I really didn't look much into the gun reform. So I really don't have an opinion on the gun reform. I just never looked at it.
Yeah, there's a kind of Colorado equanimity right there, even in that. We're looking at the state of Colorado today. Let me get a call here from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gwen is calling. Gwen, you're on the air.
Hi. I should say I'm a lefty liberal from Cambridge, Massachusetts, but okay. I would love to hear from the Colorado folks about any conversation that has gone on about looking at the concerns of secondhand smoke with marijuana, particularly as it's not just harmful to health but actually intoxicating. And I'm wondering, you talked about people, whether or not people are allowed to smoke in their front lawn. I'd love to hear, you know, we did this whole battle about tobacco smoke, and now here we are again preparing to legalize marijuana. And I just wonder about children and innocent bystanders.
Yeah, Gwen, let us pick it right up. John Long, how does the question strike you? There's the picture, you know, from the other side of the country of so much marijuana smoke around that secondhand smoke becomes an issue. Is that where Colorado's headed? Have you heard a conversation around it, John?
No, that hasn't really been part of the conversation that I'm aware. You know, the chemicals in marijuana smoke are much less dangerous than that in cigarette smoke. Nicotine, tars, 3,000 chemicals or more are found in cigarette smoke, and those attribute to a lot of problems especially for infants and others secondary, you know, breathing that air. But, you know, this isn't an issue about smoking in public. You know, Colorado and Fort Collins, you can't smoke anywhere in public. Cigarettes or otherwise, and this is something that's just now legal in your own home, or maybe in your front yard, and that I don't think that's really been part of the discussion.
Our time grows short here, Laura. What about the environmental issues we've seen in Colorado with the unbelievable fires there, the flood we saw just a couple of months ago? How are your neighbors, you yourself in Colorado Springs, taking those on board? What do you see going on with those huge challenges?
Well, obviously, it's very scary, and it's tragic for the many, many people who've been affected, both by the fires, which were maybe 2 to 3 miles away from my house, the Black Forest fire this summer. I did not have to evacuate, but as you're watching the ash drift
too close,
by, it's very, very real. I don't know that there's any huge lesson to extrapolate from this. I think the populations, especially those that are kind of butted up against the forested areas, are doing a great deal right now with the help of city and federal funds and oversight to work on mitigation to help keep that from happening again next summer. Hopefully.
Climate change always comes up when we see big weather events these days. What about that connection in your mind?
I think a couple years worth of fires and floods is not enough to extrapolate from and say that there's a huge climate change going on. I think it's part of the natural cycle. It's part of having let the forests grow up and battled fires so much in the past.
Patty, what are you thinking of on the environmental challenge front that Colorado faces, and what trend line that might or might not be part of?
Well, the whole troubles of the wildland-urban interface we were just talking about there with the populations butting up right into the mountains, and into the mountains. That is a set of human choices that are really reaping big consequences now. That to put homes, treasured homes, obviously valued and treasured homes, in the location where fire has certainly not, I mean, whatever is happening with climate change, those forests have been subject to fire for hundreds of years.
We're going to have to leave that one right there. Human choices up against forest and mountain in Colorado and a whole lot more. I want to thank you, Patty Limerick, John Long, and Laura DiSilverio, for your Colorado insights today. Help us understand. Thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.